the good mirror. It's a slightly wonky mirror, but it is a mirror, which means you've got a real antenna above the ground, and you've got a mirror image of your dipole, we'll say, below the ground. Any signal reflecting off of the ground experiences a 180-degree phase shift. It reverses in polarity. A shorter piece of cable does that. A shorter piece of waveguide does that. The signal that goes down reverses in polarity before it comes back. The signal that bounces off the ground hits the ground, reverses in polarity, and then continues with its angle of incidence equals angle of reflection. So once you admit that the real antenna above the ground is in phase, and the mirror image of the antenna below ground is out of phase, you now understand why there is, in general, a no on the horizon. You can make believe, mathematically or geometrically, that the signal above ground is doing radiating, and half the signal is also radiated from the signal below ground, the mirror image antenna, and they're out of phase. Because they're out of phase, on the horizon you have an equal length, half length, to the image antenna and to the real antenna, and they're out of phase, and therefore there's a null on the horizon. When you start looking at the antenna from above the horizon, the path length to the image antenna is getting longer than the path length to the real antenna, as you choose various angles above the ground. So at some angle above the ground, you've added an extra half wavelength of path length, therefore the out-of-phase reflection of this image antenna becomes in phase, and that's the peak of your vertical beam. You can see that that is wavelength related. So if I've got an 80-meter antenna a certain number of feet off the ground, so that now my peak of radiation is 30 degrees above the ground, because 30 degrees above the ground for my altitude of my dipole means that 30 feet above the ground and 30 feet below the ground, the two dipoles are 60 feet apart. At some particular angle, and maybe it's 30 degrees above the ground, it adds an extra path length and they go in phase. When I now go to 40 meters at twice the frequency, I've got twice the number of wavelengths above the ground. Therefore, that first lobe that comes in phase, where they go back, or I have an extra path length of 180 degrees of that wavelength, now at 40 meters, that wavelength, instead of being 30 degrees above the ground for the first That first 30 degrees above the ground, for my example, it might be 15 degrees above the ground. Because you're at a higher frequency with a shorter wavelength, my dipole is the same number of feet above the ground, is now a larger number of wavelengths above the ground. There's a larger number of wavelengths between the real image and the image antenna. Therefore, I don't have to go as many degrees above the horizon before now the extra path length to the image antenna is a half wavelength longer, and that's my first vertical lobe. And if I go higher, there's a vertical null, and then there's a second vertical lobe in most cases when you're at a high enough frequency. So you can now see that the vertical angle of radiation has got nothing to do with the pattern of your antenna itself. It doesn't matter if you're using a dipole, a Yagi, or whatever. Even in the case of a Yagi, you've got a real Yagi above the ground, you've got a mirror image of one below the ground. Those two signals are beating against each other by way of ground reflection. The geometry of ground reflection is a little bit difficult to figure out, but if you draw yourself a diagram, side view of the antenna above the ground, draw a line representing the ground and put some cross hatching on it, if you know it's the ground, then draw the second side view of the other antenna below the ground, and you start looking at various vertical angles. On the right-hand side of the page, draw a straight line to the real antenna, draw a straight line to the image antenna, and with by some not too complicated geometry, you can figure out how many extra feet there is at that angle to the image antenna versus the real antenna, calculate whether or not that is or isn't half a wavelength, and therefore you know where the vertical angle is. You can either do it that way, or you go to the appropriate chapter of the ARRL antenna book, and they'll give you a formula that does that for you. But the formula doesn't tell you what's happening. The side view image and the geometry helps me know what's happening. So that sort of explains to me why my first lobe of vertical radiation gets closer and closer to the horizon when for that particular antenna I light it up at a higher and higher frequency, which is really a smaller and smaller wavelength. Instead of more wavelengths above the ground, at the higher frequency. therefore the vertical lobe is closer to the horizon. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, just to reiterate what Dick has just said, as we were explaining earlier, if you're, and this is basically, of course, the whole attraction right now, Dick, is you must understand a great deal of HF operating, and the people want to get on the 80-meter band, the 40-meter band, some on 160, but the 80 and the 40-meter band seems to be taking the complete load of HF operations during the nighttime operation, you know, getting, if you want to get on the air, you know, and if you're interested strictly in HF operations. And the problem is, again, what do you want to do on 80 and 40 meters? Are you looking to work DX strictly? Then you're going to have to put an antenna up that will give you the right takeoff angle for going to other parts of the world. But don't try to, at the same time, work your friends possibly a few hundred miles away. That's why I have now, I have three antennas that I'm using on 80 meters. And I can honestly say, gee, you know, there is no rule of thumb, really, which antenna to use. You have to just try. I find the loop, the full wave loop, is great mostly for my communications with my friends, as I just said, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, etc. But it is miserable when it comes to working DX, whereas the vertical seems to outperform it. For DX was miserable if I wanted to work my friends in Pennsylvania and all. So you got to either have the room and the patience to do the right job on whichever antenna, or choose what you want to, you know, what you want, how you want to communicate on these bands. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah. We do a lot of construction of antennas, the serious amateurs. We do very little construction of our transmitters and receivers and feed lines. When in doubt, build more antennas. Put more wire in your backyard. For the most part, those individual wires do not interfere with each other. And lots of guys lose a lot of sleep thinking that a wire antenna that's near any of the guy wires of their tower, that the guy wires are going to interfere with it. The guy wires are going to be all broken up with egg insulators and whatever. Those extra wires that are near your antenna, whether they be Con Ed wires, LIPA wires, or your guy wires, are almost 100% transparent. If and only if that wire is not a resonant length. And for the wire to be a resonant length, you'd have to be quite unlucky. And even if that particular guy wire does turn out to be a resonant length, and you think the Cadillac approach is to put a bunch of egg insulators in that wire, I do not recommend that, because the mechanical integrity of that guy wire goes down real fast if you didn't do an excellent job of installing every one of those egg insulators with all of the guy clips around each one of them. A lot of work. And you have to disassemble a lot of critical gear on the tower in order to do it. If your guy wire just happens to be resonant, that's the only time where it's got any affected area that's going to affect your antenna. It's very easy to add an extra wire at a key angle, add an extra wire somewhere in the middle of your guy wire, and bring it over to the tower. It could almost be a clip lead, and that will kill the resonance. Killing the resonance, if you happen to be unlucky and have it, is very easy to kill. Don't add egg insulators. There's lots of guys who have set up a dipole at the exact same altitude as the Con Ed wire that was across the street. And they thought in that direction they're going to have a great big shadow. Except for a little bit of static they may get from that wire is transparent. It is not a resonant lens. That 8,500 square feet of area you get out of your 80-meter dipole is only because it's resonant. You make your dipole non-resonant, and its effector area goes down to about 1 square foot instead of 8,500. That's the same area it'll have when the sun shines through it and you create, cast a shadow on the ground. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2KEY, with a question?
Yeah, go ahead, Mel. I mean, Glenn.
Yeah, interestingly enough about guy wires, something I've never really thought of, but you might have the answer to it. Let's say if you're fortunate enough to have a guy wire that is resonant to to one of the bands that you'd like to operate on. Is there a good way of coupling to it, even though it's a grounded wire?
Grounded, ungrounded, at one end or at both ends or whatever, if it resonates. Coupling to it is easy. You could take one of the grounded ends, put your center conductor to the guy wire, I'm going to pick a number, 5 foot from that end, and put the shield to the tower. And experiment with that length, how far you are from the grounded end. You'll eventually find the point that gives you a 50 ohm impedance on that antenna, on that guy wire. With your antenna analyzer, your network analyzer, your grid dip meter, or whatever, without too much effort, you can find out what is the resonant frequency of each one of your guy wires. Once you find out what the resonant frequency is, it isn't too difficult to put a piece of T-wire off to one side. In other words, 10 feet above the ground, you grab the guy wire, bring a wire over to the tower, and don't connect it directly, connect a variable capacitor in there. And you can tune your guy wire without changing its length. You can force it to be resonant. And then loading it once it's resonant is just a matter of experimentation. There have been guys that are using their grounded guy wires by forcing them into resonance, even with a very wide range antenna tuner, into making rather good slope radiators. Once it resonates, it will radiate. You can't stop it from doing that. I bet you that gives you some ideas, Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
It's an excellent idea. Something I always thought of, but I guess what's still bothering me is, let me just get a clearer picture in my head of how this is working. You think I'm attaching the center lead of coax to the guy wire, but now am I attaching it closer to the top? But then again, the top is also grounded to the tower, isn't it? At the top end, so are you coming off of the top and then going, or are you going down on the ground end and attaching center lead maybe like 5 feet from the ground? Because I'm trying to get a better picture in my head of exactly how the coax is being attached.
Okay, first I'm going to have to describe resonance to you. Let's assume now that I've got a jumping rope. I got two kids holding onto a rope, and they're about to swing it in order to have a person in the middle do jumping. If I now go the next step and make believe I've got two vertical posts into the ground, and I got a piece of wire between the two, and I start pushing on the wire with my hand, I will very rapidly find the first point of resonance on the wire. That's where the two ends of the wire that are connected to the post do not move, but the center of the wire has the maximum movement straight up and straight down, if I'm using linear polarization. By the way, when your kids do jump rope, they're doing circular polarization, but I won't go there right now. So when I move the rope in such a way, or the wire in such a way, that the center of it goes up and down and the end sits still, that's the first primary half-wavelength resonance. That's exactly what the current waveform looks like on your half-wave dipole. Because the dipole is open-circuited on the end, the current goes to zero on the end. In the case of a piece of wire that's being moved between two posts, the movement of the wire represents the current. Maximum current in the center for the dipole, maximum movement of the wire in this half-wave resonance. That's the first half-wave resonance. The next full wave of resonance is when I move the wire in such a way that the left-hand side, one-third of the way from the left-hand side is going up, one-third of the way from the right-hand side is going down, and the middle isn't moving. The middle is moving like a seesaw. That's the second mode of resonance. So in any of these modes of resonance, and you can do this with a bowstring, you can do it with a guitar string, you can do it with a wire between two posts, you can do it with your guy wire. Walk over to your guy wire and move it with your hand just the right way. You can find each of these modes of resonance. Let me drop. Once you can see in your mind the mode of resonance, you can recognize the fact that at the grounded end, the voltage, so to speak, is zero. The voltage in the center is extremely high. At the end, the impedance is zero. At the center, the impedance is a few thousand ohms. Choose the right position along that wire, and you will find the point that when it's radiating is 50 ohms resistive. Now, feeding power into that point is a little bit on the difficult side, because where is the counterpoise for you to feed? Semiconductor is going to go to the lighter at that point, and ground of the shield is going to go to whatever is the local ground, probably the tower. That's if you're feeding it directly as a TMAX, so to speak. You can also feed it as a gamma. You can feed it, gamma is probably the best way. Run a piece of wire parallel, starting at the point of connection to the tower. Set a conductor of your coax. Shield of the coax goes to the tower locally. Set a conductor goes to the gamma rod. The gamma rod runs parallel to the guy wire a certain length, has a coupling capacitor, and then goes over and touches the guy wire. You can see what a gamma feeding rod would look like. And there's lots of different ways you can feed it. So once you establish the resonance, once you feed it at the right point, once you correct for the extra reactance of your feeding structure, that's what the gamma rod is doing. The gamma rod is a kind of a series inductor, but you've got a series capacitor in the gamma rod which cancels that inductance. That allows you to reach into that point of the dipole or to your guy wire and feed a signal there without creating an extra inductance. It's a matter of experimentation. I wonder if you can sort of see the principle, Glenn. KC2QIQ, I think it is. K2RIW.
K2RIW, KC2QIQ. Yeah, no, definitely, Dick. It's an idea I've always thought of. And, you know, I've always wondered about, you know, making the match there and see how you do it. I don't know if, for me personally, it would be practical to make the T-match, but certainly the gamma match, to actually make a gamma rod and try to tune the guy wires with an antenna analyzer and to see where exactly I can make them resonate with. And just an interesting idea because they're almost like the antennas for free. Yeah, add them right on. But thanks for the little hint there. K2RAW, KP2QIQ.
Now this is a whole concept that has never been given proper use. And now once you resonate one of your guy wires, and you've got at least three of them on your tower, you've got three different directions. You can start using them in combinations as a phased array. Feed half the power into the northern one, feed half the other half your power into the southeast one, adjust the phase shift between the two, and get various angles of radiation out to the azimuth and the horizon. Feed all three of them in various combinations. Once you can resonate one, why not use the other two? And once you find a way of resonating on one band, I guarantee you can find a way of resonating it on a higher harmonic on some other band. That could be a lot of fun. Wonder if you've ever used any of your guy wires as a radiator, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Nope, this is K2KEY, and I'll tell you why. I've got it broken up with egg insulators, and I'm going to tell you a whole story about this now, because I've got the official ARRL antenna handbook out, and I'm going to give you some quotes. But first of all, let me say this much. I have tried shunt feeding power using his shunt fed system with the gamma rod, and the problem basically with shunt feeding the power is you do have to work it against a very good ground system, you know, of radio. So first of all, there's a number of other factors, and that is also down at the bottom is a problem that, you know, it sticks out to the yard and everything, and it's just, you know, it does present some possible danger because your whole matching network and everything has to be located right down on the bottom there, you know, right down on the ground level. So I sort of tried it, but half-heartedly. Now, as far as breaking up the guy wires, I'm going to read this. I don't know if you've ever read this portion of the ARRL handbook, Dick, over.
I have, and I've not completely agreed with that section. They've got some very complicated mathematics and all kinds of egg insulators they want to break up every possible oscillation, every possible resonance on all of the ham bands. And I disagree with that because mechanically it's not a good thing to do. You end up with a large number of egg insulators. Most of our guy wires, when they hit resonance, it's going to be a rather narrow 2 or 3% bandwidth of that resonance. Unless you're very unlucky, none of your guy wires are going to hit resonance on any of your particular frequencies. And if they do, killing that resonance by putting a clip lead on the guy wire, in my opinion, is very easy. I would rather put various couplings to kill the resonances rather than put egg insulators all over the place. The egg insulator is the Cadillac approach, RF-wise. Mechanical engineering-wise, it is lower than the Volkswagen approach because I think you're giving up a lot of the mechanical integrity because the chain is no stronger than the weakest link. In the case of one of my guy wires, which is over 200 feet long, I'd be putting a whole lot of egg insulators in there. If any one of those connections on either end of any one of those egg insulators fail, that guy wire fails. And in my opinion, that would be very serious in my case. Back to you, Mel.
Why not using the guy wire as an antenna pin to an anyone?
But the guy wire itself makes a good antenna. But the guy wire is there on the tower, free of charge, and you can make it into an antenna. That's what we're discussing. And yes, you can put egg insulators in there to force it to be specific length for certain portions of the guy wire. I don't agree with that. To me, a guy wire is an extremely important mechanical engineering fixture that either determines whether my tower stands or falls over. I want to have the minimum interference with that guy wire. I want to make sure that the guy wire itself is very strong, low in rust, and that the ends of it are extremely securely connected. And I want as few connections as possible. And all the extra connections you got to do to put on egg insulators scares the hell out of me. But that's one man's attitude, one man's opinion. Back to you, Mel. C2LIW.
Hey, Roger. All right, well, in the case of the antenna I have up there, I have a Mosley. And that antenna, six elements, they had sent me detailed information on, you know, mounting it on a tower. And the caution was, if you do not break up these guy wires for a guy tower, in fact, they give you a whole bunch of charts of how to break them up and their lengths, and I hope this is similar to what's in the manual here. They emphasize that this beam will not, under any circumstances, perform correctly, and they have confirmed this by many tests. So I remember that distinctly, and I have here also that exactly the way it says here in the ARRL book, that without doing that, you will run it into a conductive material will cause the distortion of the antenna radiation pattern. And the only way to take care of this is by breaking each guy into non-resonant lengths using strain insulators. And they show you the pictures of them, how to install them, and so forth. And then they said, this is continued in detail later in the chapter. And later in the chapter, they go into that whole thing about, like you say, a lot of mathematics and charts and things, and says, guy wires will alter or distort the radiation pattern of a nearby antenna, especially for low frequency. So, the symptoms of re-rating guy wires are usually a lower front-to-back ratio on your beam, and so on and so forth. So, they are insistent that the ARRL, that you go ahead and break them up with insulate. In fact, their power is, if you go take a look at their installation in Newington, their power is broken up with insulators, egg insulators, Dick, over.
I think Mosley did that, Mel, to be super conservative. They don't want people coming back claiming that, gee, you said that my Mosley antenna is going to have X number of dB of front-to-back ratio and Y number of dB of front-to-side ratio and Z number of dB of forward gain. And so they would love to use as an excuse the fact that you mounted it on a tower with guy wires and the guy wires are creating that disturbance. And if my antenna would normally have an 18 dB front-to-back ratio and because of a local guy wire it's got a 16 dB front-to-back ratio, Mosley wants to be able to blame it on your guy wire system as opposed to a fault in their particular antenna. So for them to claim that you've got to do all this gives them a beautiful way out if you're unhappy with that antenna. But my experience with local resonators tells me that radio-wise, every antenna we talk about only is an antenna if it has an effective capture area. A piece of wire only has an effective capture area worth talking about if it hits resonance. And that resonance is about a 3% bandwidth phenomenon. So unless you're very unlucky, I think your guy wires on most of your ham frequencies will not resonate. You got a couple of points in the chart, each with 3% width, where they're going to hit resonance. So, and those guy wires slope away from the antenna at ridiculous angles. So your Mosley antenna on top of that tower, to claim that those guy wires that are sloping away at a 45, 50, or 60 degree angle compared to the antenna, to say that they're creating a large amount of interference to the antenna, I think it's hogwash. But I haven't mounted a Mosley. I haven't run the experiment. I've done the equivalent on lots of occasions on VHF and UHF frequencies, where I am now resonating antennas an inch or two away from a whole lot of hardware. I'm taking 900 megacycle antennas that are a couple of inches away from printed circuit boards, optical scanning engines, antennas for wireless LAN and 802.11 and GPI, global positioning satellite, and all of this kind of jazz. Lots and lots of other antennas and other pieces of hardware which you would think would all hit resonance. And they're only an inch or two away from a 915 megacycle high-performance antenna. I have found ways of retuning the antenna in the presence of all of that hardware. So you can either lose a lot of sleep around this, or wait until the problem has and happens and then start applying corrective action. The super conservative approach is to put guy wires with a zillion egg insulators, or use insulated guy wires, glass lines. I don't think you got to do that. I think it's an over effort, in my opinion, at high risk. But that's one man's opinion. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, what I'm reading here, this was an experiment that was done by K1TD, Jerry, and he drew the charts and everything, and it shows you the length of guy wires and which bands will affect. And it's usually the top guy wires, as you get down lower, he says the effect becomes, less of virtue. And so suggests, he shows you that in his experiment, what happens with the antenna, and, goes through a whole, quite a bit, there's a whole chapter on it, Dick. So I don't know what to say. However, I will say that smart at the ARRL, and I do believe they do have smarts there. I mean, the guys that they put up antennas, they did a beautiful job on the new system. According to the pictures I've seen, a few of my friends went to visit, they redid their whole antenna system and all, and it's plain in the pictures that their guy wires definitely have egg insulators installed in them, Dick, over.
I have no doubt that ARRL did it. They were paying a service to install those guy wires, to install those egg insulators. It made a 10% change in the installation fee. It gave them super conservative capability of putting up any antenna in the future and not worrying about this. I have no doubt in my mind they did it, and from their point of view, they did it for the right reasons. For you and I to do that, I think, is excessive. I think the chances of us getting a problem are slim. And because we are reasonably curious, science-like people, when we did run into a problem, we would dig in, we'd investigate it, we'd find out what's going wrong, and we'd apply a very simple corrective action. In my opinion, the zillions of egg insulators on the guy wires is an overcorrection. It's too enthusiastic. There's lots of situations like this where somebody expresses an opinion on paper, it seems very valid, people follow it, they get good results, therefore they know they did the right thing. I think there's a 95% chance they would have gotten good results if they did nothing. To be super conservative, they did it. I don't think they had to do it. I think the difference in performance would have been very small. I think we're talking about an 18 dB front to back ratio that became 16.5 dB. That kind of jazz. That's not a showstopper. And even if you did run into that resonance that did that, because the guy wire slopes away at such an angle, the coupling to the guy wire is so darn minor, to detune the resonance at that frequency would be so easy. That's my opinion. I wouldn't do it. If you've got a very professional rigging crew that's installing all those egg insulators and they do a very good job, yes, that can be a situation with high integrity. The average amateur that I have seen install guy wires, where they have nothing to do but put one connector assembly on each end of that wire, and I look at the way they connected just that one end and what the safety procedures and what backup procedures they use on it, and it horrifies me. So if the most of the installations I've seen by my fellow amateurs, where I see the way they connect a wire on one end, and in my opinion it's kind of marginal, and if they're going to put 10 of those connections in the process of putting 5 egg insulators, I think it's an experiment, I think it's asking for a disaster. But that's my feeling on the subject. K2KEY,
K2LIW. This is K2KEY, and I just the final words on it here, and I said that the gain of the antenna, the feed point impedance will usually be significantly affected through all those, and changes in the SWR will be noted as the antenna is rotated. This is definitely caused by re-radiating of your guy wires. And, of course, that's why they also tell you that this is mandatory on the upper guy wires, especially if they fall into the length of this chart and he's got guy wires anywhere from 10 feet up to 150 feet, and which band especially is going to affect the most. I like to say, Dick, I don't know. I won't say one way or the other, because I have not experimented first. It's too much work. I mean, while I was changing the guy wires, I said egg insulators were there. They were in there on the system for how many years? I finally changed the guy wires after about 25 years. They were rusted. They were corroded. Everything. I took them down. I put the new egg insulators, the new buckles on there with those locks and things and everything. I put a slight braid across the where they join together, and they are. So what can I say? what do we recommend? I don't know. So I guess they say the jury is out. All right. Shall we go on?
Yes, we should, but I'm going to add two more words to this one now. They hinted that they saw a change in gain, they saw a change in VisWire when they rotated the antenna. They didn't tell us how much. If the antenna had a 1.5 standing wave ratio, and if a particular guy wire at that particular band happened to hit resonance, and as they rotated it, the VisWire went up to 1.6, even if it went up to 2.0, that's only half a dB of loss, worst case. Until they tell me how much grief they've got, I don't believe it. Yeah, they saw a change. And if they didn't understand the physics of what's going on, it may have been a small change by my standards, and they may have been horrified by the fact that they saw a change. Until they tell me how much the front-to-back changed, how much the front-to-side changed, how much the gain changed, or how much the VisWire changed when they rotated, until they tell me the magnitude, I'm having trouble believing that this is significant. If they saw a 1.5 go to a 1.6 and they were horrified, I think it's unjustified. I guess we've dwelled enough on this one, and maybe we're all going to agree to disagree, and maybe I'm alone on this one. I've done many of my 2-meter antennas and 432 antennas have been mounted in the middle of a tower where they look through two sets of guy wires. I have yet to see anything significant happen when I rotate them in various directions. Maybe I'm a lucky guy. It hasn't given me the slightest amount of grief. I'll admit I didn't look real hard for it. I didn't set up my, let me drop. I didn't carefully set up my bird watt meter and look at the reflective power that represents a 1.2 Vizwar and rotate the antenna. I did rotate a Yagi in the middle of my tower that's on its own yard arm, and I would see the Vizwar go from 1.2 to 1.7 when the Yagi was aimed into the tower. That's a significant interruption. And I could still easily copy signals in that direction. The tower was sufficiently transparent, even though it's a massive chunk of steel, and the signal is drifting through the spaces in that tower and around the tower, I still talk to people in that direction. I think the signal was a dB weaker in that direction than it should have been, but how significant is that when you transmit into the tower with a Yagi that you rotate in that direction? And the tower is a hell of a lot more massive than a guy wire. My gut feel here is that we're spitting in the ocean and trying to measure the change in the tide level here, Mel. But I can see how people will disagree with me. And those people at headquarters probably sincerely believe this. I don't think they've questioned it. They've accepted it. It's become everyone believes it and no longer questions the situation. Very similar to what happens with UHF connectors. There's a zillion people out there that are absolutely positive. They would swear in a pack of Bibles that every UHF connector has half a dB of loss at 432 megacycles. Pure hogwash. I've done that experiment. That's an old wives' tale that refuses to die. I think the Zeke insulator one quite possibly is another one. That's my feeling on it. Go to the next one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2QIQ with a quick comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Go ahead, Radio Fox.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Read that book written by Maxwell W2DU. W2DU, yes. Reflections, end to end.
All right, we'll go to that Maxwell book in a second. Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Dick, I think you might have seen a picture of an antenna that I have. It's a three-element Yagi, and I can rotate it from horizontal to vertical. And when I go from horizontal to vertical, and I have ground, I have guy wire cables coming off of it as well that don't have any egg insulators in them at all. And when I rotate the antenna around in horizontal, I might see maybe from 1.1 to 1.2 VSWR change to max. And when I go from horizontal to vertical, now I've got the mast pole in between the driver and the director. And now the directing element is coming within, I don't know, about 12 inches, 15 inches of the mast pole. And even then, the worst VSWR change I've ever seen in the antenna might be between 1.45, maybe 1.5 to 1. And that's the worst I've seen with that. It's pretty hard to believe that guy wires by themselves, which aren't even nearly as drastic as the mast coming in between the bottom half of the driving element, would cause that much trouble.
I thank you for that, Glenn. That's a piece of pretty hard evidence that's in the direction of what I'm saying. It's not proof, but it's a darn good piece of evidence. The person who's talking about the W2DU, Irv Maxwell, give us your call letters, your name, and proceed with your comments, sir. My name is Dick.
Hello, Dick. Hello, everybody. This is November 2, November, November uniform. My name is Alex. It so happened that I'm involved in RF design, and to my astonishment, I know a little bit about it. I guess every one of us should read the W2DU book, Reflections, as it explains in great detail exactly what you said, Dick, about SWR and everything else related to inducting RF into wires hanging from the tower. It's a very good instructive reading. I guess I read it four times. Back to you.
Very fine, Alex. Alex, give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch. Now, you've recently read one of those four times, the W2DU book on reflection. Approximately what did he say about how bad are the guy wires in the vicinity of, say, a Yagi antenna on top of the tower? I'm led to believe that Irv Maxwell, who I knew pretty well when he used to live up here in our neighborhood, I'm pretty sure he's going to say that, except for some rare exceptions, guys are worrying rather unnecessarily about this problem. Is that approximately what he was saying, Alex? N2, NNU, K2RIW.
Well, for what he is saying, from what I found out of my experience and what the theoretical books are saying, is that any element, conductive element, that is not spaced a quarter wavelength away from the source, and it is not a quarter wave or a resonant to a quarter wavelength on the frequency of operation, is totally transparent. This is why Faraday cages are built with materials like a mesh, taking into account the lowest frequency possible that they will use it as, so they will become transparent up to that frequency. In general, you are right, I say, W2DU is right, and the book probably teaches a lot of things about that. I think we, the radio amateurs, must read more.
Very fine, Alex. Awful glad you signed it. I think you're giving support to what Glenn and I are saying and what our experience is saying. If I look at the rate at which the signal falls off from an antenna, the inverse square law, and if I look at the what's called radar cross-section of these chunks of metal, called guy wires, the guy wires slope away from the tower, slope away from the antenna, they're a significant number of feet away, they've got a physical cross-section that's rather small. If they don't get resonance, they're rather small in their radar cross-section. There's a significant amount of signal fall-off until you get to that guy wire that's, say, 10 feet away. And then the reflection from that guy wire, if it happens to be resonant, has to go another 10 feet to get back to your antenna. I'm convinced we're talking about second-order effects here, rather minor effects, with rare exception. I think a lot of amateurs have lost a lot of sleep over this issue. The average guy putting up an inverted Z dipole would be horrified if the inverted Z dipole is anywhere near the same altitude as a set of guy wires on that tower. The average amateur would be absolutely positive it can't work. It's going to die. If he actually did it, he would be very pleasantly surprised. I ran an inverted Z dipole at the exact same altitude as one of the sets of guy wires on one of my towers. Worked like a charm. So, I think we're worrying very unnecessarily about what I'm fairly convinced is a second order effect. I've got a little bit of experience in this. I wouldn't say it's an absolute open and shut case, but you can see where my opinion is coming from. And my VHF-UHF experience has taught me one thing. Let me drop. Almost everything in radio scales. I can take my favorite four-element Yagi at 915 megacycles, and I know that if I scaled every one of the materials and make it a four-element Yagi on 40 meters, I would get the exact same performance in free space. I will admit, when I go down to 40 meters, I'm going to start worrying about how many wavelengths around am I above the ground, and I'm going to be getting some ground effects. Now, ground, Earth, is a huge reflecting surface. And that's giving you a god-awful echo from the antenna down to the ground, back to the antenna. And if I studied the vizuar I get of my, let's say, three-element Yagi on 20 meters or 40 meters, the change in vizuar versus altitude of the antenna, if I had it on one of these riser-type things where I could change the altitude up and down the tower of my three-element Yagi while I'm measuring vizuar, you'd be amazed how small the change is until the antenna is only a couple of feet off the ground. Ground is a huge reflecting object, and it's a minor effect on vizuar of an antenna at any reasonable altitude. And you take something that is a hell of a lot less substantial, a piece of wire, at a crazy angle to the antenna. And if you think that's going to be a big interference to the antenna, wow, we're talking about very minor effects, in my opinion. Now you know where it's coming from. I could be wrong, but everything I've done tends to support that opinion. I will not put guy wire egg insulators in my guy wires. If I ran into a resonance, I would very simply kill that resonance by putting a random piece of wire at right angles to the guy wire. It can easily kill the resonance at that frequency. I'd much rather do that because I'm not interfering with the integrity of the guy wire. Well, unless I've done an excellent job on every one of those egg insulators, I think I'm affecting the integrity of the guy wires of that tower. For a guy like Mel who knows how to do it, they don't worry. An awful lot of my amateur friends, when they install guy wires, it scares me. And to take that improper understanding of the what makes a guy wire have high integrity, and now to stretch it to doing it 12 times in a row by putting three egg insulators in each of those guy wires, I think it's asking for disaster. I recommend they don't do it for a bunch of reasons. We probably rolled on this one long enough, Mel. K2KEY, KQRIW. And Alex, thanks again. You got it, Mel.
K2QIQ with a couple more words.
Segmentation of the guides.
Okay. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, just one more quick comment about, you know, wires getting in the way in affecting fields. And that, Dick, you know yourself from designing many Yagis, that in order to get a quarter wave element in the direct path of the radiator to upset the pattern or to redirect the pattern, it's very difficult to get it in the right position to really cause a very, very strange effect to the pattern of that antenna. So when you have an antenna or a wire that's not necessarily a quarter wavelength, at 45 degrees from the direct path of the antenna, it's very, very hard to see that you're going to have any kind of an effect.
Okay, so with Alex, Glenn, and Dick here, there are three people with reasonably strong opinions and a little bit of confirming evidence in that direction. I think you see why we feel this way, Mel. What you did is not wrong. You did the right thing, and it's the super conservative, and it's the Cadillac approach. And for you, it's the right thing to do. For the average amateur who only partially understands how to do a good job of installing guy wires, I don't recommend they do it. You got it, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, let me put it to you this way. It is a hard sell if you're going to sell an antenna system that's going to cost you a kilobuck today. And when it's rotated, they're going to see a change in the SWR as it's rotated. Oh, boy. If you have that, that's a professional installation, you're going to hear from it. In fact, I just dug out final words. I just dug out this thing on Mosley. And he says, if you see any change in the SWR as this beam is rotated, it will significantly, and he has it underlined, significantly affect the radiation pattern of this antenna. And then he's got charts which shows you how it flattens out with it. I can say, how a change in the SWR, and he's nearly knocking it down to literally to nothing, and showing you how a change in the SWR of just a slight bit, how it changes the pattern of this beam. So, I can say, hard sell to to tell somebody, don't worry about it, that little change is not going to have any effect. Think if they won't, they'll lose sleep over it, you know it. So, I wouldn't possibly go on that route. They want to put the egg insulators in and make them happy. I would never say don't do it, because they're going to come back and haunt you and say, that thing never worked right, and because I listened to you. You know, I am very careful how I give people advice, to tell you the truth, Dick. Over.
Do you have one more comment?
Yeah, Glenn recognized. To be conservative, to make sure that your friends don't come back and say, gee, I listened to you and you got me in trouble, you're right. But I'm going to give you a quick break on this one, Mel. If I had an antenna that's giving me a 1.3 standing wave ratio when it's aimed to the north, and now I swing the antenna 360 degrees and the VizWire changes, tell me, not make believe you hadn't read Mosley's words, and I think they were very exaggerated. Make believe you hadn't measured Mosley's words, but you're taking your understanding of standing wave ratio, and you're starting off with a 1.3. And as you rotate the antenna 360 degrees, the VizWire somewhere in there does change. My question to you, Rep Mel, is where, in your opinion, is your threshold of alarm? If it goes from 1.3 to 1.4, are you going to be alarmed? If it goes from 1.3 to 2.0, are you going to be alarmed? Where, in your opinion, is the proper threshold of alarm? Back to you for a quick one on that one, Bill.
Okay, been there. I had a friend that put the tower up on the roof on one of his small roof towers, and he rotated the beam. He was going over the, you know, the copper gutters on the edge of the roof and or whatever is in the roof, coax, BX cables and all, and there was a change. And he says, what do I do? What do I do? I'm sure this is not performing correctly. I said, well, the only thing you can do, you got to go up higher. He said, well, I can't do that. I said, then you have to live with it. There's the word. You have to live with it. If it's something you can remedy, maybe by putting a few egg insulators that makes you perfectly happy, of course I know and you know it's not going to make any appreciable effect, but psychological, they'll say, I can see how I'm getting better signal report. They won't say the propagation improved, but do you see how I have heard people do things? Dick, one guy insists that he changed the wire from number 14 wire to number 12 wire, and he's telling me how many more dBs of gains getting out of the antenna on 75 meters. I just don't argue it out. I said, well, sounds good. He says, next year I'm going to put number 10 wire, and you'll see the difference. What am I supposed to say, Dick? You give me an answer. How would you answer these questions, over?
Are they having engineering people work?
You're absolutely right, Mel and Alex. And by the same token, you and I can go and spend $150 for four-gauge wire that operates between my hi-fi amplifier and my loudspeakers. And I can buy wires that have all kinds of fancy fluids in the middle of the wire. The wire is made in a tubular manner, and it's supposedly going to give me rounder sound to the music. You can buy these things, and people believe it. And I'm afraid to tell them that they're wasting their money, because if they want to believe it hard enough, it's very difficult to change somebody's belief. It's almost like trying to talk them into changing their religion. Very, very difficult. Glenn, I know you wanted to make some comments. Go ahead, Glenn.
The only time I had a problem with an antenna when I rotated it that had a VSWR problem, very, very interesting thing. It took a long time to debug it. What I found out the problem is, this is a really hard one to swallow, but the rotator, when I measured the top half of the bell rotator with the hand 4, the bottom half of the pole, I was getting like an intermittent grounding as the antenna rotated between the top and the bottom. One would think that that aluminum housing would have an excellent ground. What I actually had to do was take a piece of ground wire, flexible ground wire, put a clamp on the top half of the mast, on the top half of the rotor, to just below it, so it would have enough room to swing around. And that took out enough of the static for the improper grounding potential between the top of the bell rotor to the bottom. And all of a sudden, I could swing 360 degrees and just blow the move an inch.
The problem in the installation of the cabling, it's not the rotor that is the problem.
Yeah, I think you're right, Alex. You'd be amazed how many of these ham ams have got some funny internal grounding, which, depending on what the grounding is like in the shack, you're completing a circuit between the upper half of the bell and the household wiring and the bottom half of the bell, which is connected to the tower, which is grounded. I've seen things like that. I've seen scratchy contacts and voltage jumps. You know, if you put a voltmeter between the two, you would watch the voltage jump up and down as the rotator rotates. And the AC voltage is present there sometimes, and it shouldn't be with a proper installation. And anywhere you've got RF energy and scratchy contacts going on, two pieces of metal coming close to each other near any kind of a transmitting or receiving antenna is capable of making static, because the receiver is looking at fractions of a microvolt. It's a very sensitive thing, and it will change with very minor changes nearby. So a scratchy ground wire, a guy wire that's making a scratchy contact to the tower by some means, can be making a QR Nancy for you. QR Mary, QR Nancy. I'll accept that. We almost don't have time to squeeze in another one. It's up to you, Mel, if you want to try. K2KEY, K2LAW.
I guess we have it. All right. Well, just a final word, son. You mentioned something very interesting about stereo. The store in New York sells high-end stereos, and I know a guy that's a real audiophile, and he went ahead and bought speakers, a couple thousand, I don't know how much thousand, maybe $5,000 a speaker. and they sold him wire. He showed me the wire. It, if they have oxygen-free copper wire, they insist on this if you're going to buy the system. Otherwise, they do not guarantee it's going to perform correctly. Now, you tell me about oxygen-free copper, Dick, over.
Yeah, when it comes to microwave circuits, you can buy oxygen-free copper surfaces, which are usually also protected by some other layer of something. And it gives you a little bit higher surface conductivity when you've got RF skin effect going on. But at audio frequencies, all of that audio current is flowing through every bit of the depth of that wire. I don't care if it's a 4-0 wire, just like your 60 cycle current. I've got 4-0 wire on a 250 amp service to my house, 4-0 aluminum wire, and I know that at 60 hertz, all of that current is flowing through all of the depth of that wire. At audio, it's doing that. There is very little skin effect at audio. So if they ran a side-by-side test with oxygen-free copper and non-oxygen-free copper, and if they used laboratory instrumentation traceable to the Bureau, and they're trying to see the difference between 32 dB down total harmonic distortion versus 32.1 dB down total harmonic distortion, they might see that difference. And if you then tell me that a human ear can hear that difference, I got a bridge in Brooklyn I want to sell you. And it goes over to, in fact, that bridge, the extension to that bridge goes over to Manhattan Beach. Isn't that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, do you think I'm going to, I would want to stand there and say this is a bunch of nonsense? You don't think so. This is a, you don't have any idea that you've got to watch what you say, because they'll come back on you and, boy, and I could tell you with a bean, Carl Moseley, and I knew Carl Moseley, he was a perfectionist. He, I mean, he was supplying, he became after, well, you know, originally Telrex, and then Moseley took over the supplying of a lot of the antennas. He was in competition, in fact, with Collins to install antennas at the silos. You've, I guess, seen those antenna systems that they were installing at the silos. So he was emphatic. Oh, you couldn't say one word to him. Anything he wrote in his instructions here was the Bible. So you think, Dick, you think I'm going to go against these guys on 75 meters at midnight and tell them this is all a bunch of bunk? They'll go out and they'll buy oxygen-free wire for their antenna system and send. God knows how much it is a foot today with the way copper has gone, but, oh, you just tell them that number 10 copper wire is going to give you a couple of dB gain on your dipole, and I will bet you they'll go out and buy it, Dick. That's my last words on it. Good night.
Well, you're talking about people with a strong belief and a passion, and it's almost a religion. Quite often their attitude is, my mind is made up. Don't confuse me with facts. I'm saying I've been there, and you're right. You don't try to change the mind of a person with that strong an opinion. You guys have been listening to TechNet number 1190. You wasted another 4 hours of your life. The price is right. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. And we're going to try to settle a couple of these items next week. Back to you, Mel. Bye-bye for now.
I'm ahead. Today's Wally Wilder, some information and suggestions. He's listening.
Did you say something in 2GOT?
Mel, I just wanted to go over to 7-3 with you really quick.
Okay, and
1 minute.
Okay, RYY, did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, this is addressed to use. I don't know if you have access into with the node here that's only connected to 9126, but if you do have the ability to change it, or if you can get the power to be to change it, you can listen to space shuttle audio but not by going to reflector 9877. That's being piped up from one of the nodes out of the JPL out in California. It just might be interesting listening to it from time to time.
Okay, thank you. 9877 is the space shuttle. Good information.
Let me just quickly say goodnight to all. And this is K2KTY. We'll look for you next week. Take care, everyone.
That's 9877. What is it, megahertz or what?
That's the node number when you go through internet connection to get to these repeaters.
Ah, okay. All right, I thought it's real life. All right. M2N any.
Well, thank you, Alex, and please come back more often.
The time is 12 a.m. 73. And good. Thank you. From...